Welcome to Authors on Tour Live, a weekly podcast for people who love to hear about books from the authors themselves. My name is Darren Fote, and today we are podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore, one of the premier independent bookstores in the nation, with three locations in the Metro Denver area. Tonight's author on tour is Jane Smiley, who reads from and discusses her new book, 10 Days in the Hills, published by Anchor. In the weeks to come, we have Francis Ritchie and many more. You can visit www.authorsontourlive.com for a complete list of upcoming podcasts. Wait a minute, it's time to begin.
Good evening, everyone, and welcome. On behalf of the Tattered Cover, I'd like to take this opportunity to thank you for being here and for your support of independent bookselling. We very much appreciate your patronage. Our event tonight with special guest Jane Smiley is something new and I think very exciting. We'll be taping a segment of KCFR Presents with Dan Dreyer. So, without further ado, please join me in welcoming Dan Dreyer.
Thank you. I'm Dan Dreyer, and welcome to KCFR Presents. Today, we're at the Tattered Cover Bookstore in lower downtown Denver. My guest is Jane Smiley, author of numerous nonfiction books and essays, including 13 Ways of Looking at the Novel. She also writes fiction, including Moo and 1,000 Acres, which won the 1992 Pulitzer Prize. Smiley's latest novel, and her 12th, is 10 Days in the Hills. Now, with a nod to Boccaccio's Decameron, Smiley's book takes place near Hollywood the day after the 2003 Academy Awards and just days after the start of the second Gulf War. The characters include a film director, his girlfriend, an actress, her lover who also is her therapist, a producer, and some intense Russian movie financiers. They spend 10 days talking about politics and art, and they plot an X-rated, maybe NC-17 version of a film borrowed on My Dinner with Andre. And they also talk about an epic, bloody, we'll call it probably an NC-17 version, a remake of Nikolai Gogol's novel Taras Bulba. They also eat, they make love, they fight, mostly about the Persian Gulf, and they watch movies. Jane Smiley, welcome.
Thank you. Thank you.
10 Days in the Hills was published last year, and It's now available in paperback. I wondered if you would talk about what it's like to, having already gone through the first round of road tours and interviews, to come back for the second round.
Well, actually, this is the third round because I did a round in England also.
Okay.
So I found that with this novel, I still enjoy reading this novel. And so it's not a problem for me to read from it or to go back to it after a year and look into it again. It's a long novel, and like everybody else, I don't remember it perfectly, so I don't mind dipping into it at all. As far as the travel and that goes, the last tour last year was more or less in the East, and I got stuck in O'Hare. I lost my bags in O'Hare. And then I got chased out of Toronto by another snowstorm and never made it to Boston. So this is perfect. The weather's great, and the planes are running, at least so far.
So,
and it's really good.
It's like being on first tour again, at least.
Yeah.
And what's it like to answer questions from people that you may feel like you're asking you the same questions over and over again?
Oh, but they don't ask the same questions. Oh, I love to answer questions. I've never met a question I didn't want to answer or thought was a stupid question, except when the children say, "Mom, are you awake?" other than that, I love to answer questions. That's my favorite part. So it doesn't. I just the opportunity to do it again is fine with me.
You said you like rereading 10 Days in the Hills. Is that common? Do you like rereading everything you've written, or this one in particular? You don't mind going back to?
This one and Horse Heaven. I don't mind going back to. I think that's because they have a lot of variety of tone, and the ones that are more unified in tone, like 1,000 Acres, those don't interest me as much. I like things to be a little scintillating and I like there to be a lot of chiaroscuro in the books that I read. Mm-hmm. So these books are books that, or those two books are books that suit me quite well.
And talk about the what do you mean by variation of tone?
Well, there are ten personalities here gathered in this house, and they didn't intend to be gathered in this house. Some of them came by mistake. Others came sort of uninvited. But once they get there, the house, you have to imagine, is in Pacific Palisades, which is across the 405 from Hollywood and Los Angeles. And it's a steep sort of dry mountainous area. And so they have the feeling that they're in a kind of aery and that they're a little bit protected from the world and from what's going on. And even though every so often one of the characters says, gee, I need to get out of here, they can't really bring themselves to do that. That's for the first 6 days. Now, in the Decameron, Boccaccio takes his 10 characters who are suffering along with the rest of Florence from the Black Death, and he gives them a break and sends them out into to a beautiful castle in the Tuscan countryside. And then on day 6, he sends them to an even more beautiful castle, which has its thematic references to Boccaccio's beliefs and to the works that he was using for his book. But that meant that I had to send mine to an even more fabulous place, not too far from them.
Still
as Boccaccio,
yeah.
but it has to be in Brentwood. I'm sorry to say. Pacific Palisades has no place fancy enough. So because I was doing Taras Bulba, because I was using Taras Bulba as my movie project, I thought, well, who would want to finance a remake of Taras Bulba? Nobody, except a bunch of Russian billionaires or some Russian billionaires who would be interested in Gogol. I imagined them being, one of them at least being Ukrainian, actually not Russian. Mm. And as soon as I thought those words, Russian billionaire, I remembered 1995 when I went on a little State Department jaunt to St. Petersburg right after the collapse of the Soviet Union. And we were taken to the Summer Palace. And the Summer Palace was Catherine the Great's sort of grand, huge, amazing, and very strange place outside of St. Petersburg. And it had rooms with themes. And I thought, okay, well, if I were a Russian billionaire and I had all the money in the world, I would build that house. And I found a spot off Sepulveda where you could imagine somebody driving to the top of the hill and then going over a little ridge and having a beautiful place. But there is no place like this there. But so that was fun for me. I made up movies. I made up paintings. I made up actresses, you know, I made up all kinds of things, and making up the Russian house was really fun for me.
And you mixed the made-up movies in with the real movies.
Yes.
Zoe Cunningham, the actress, is in a number of movies, and there are references to living actors. And I thought, I don't think this is a real movie at one point, in a film called The Day the Earth Caught Fire.
Oh,
has anybody ever seen that? Okay, a few people.
Oh, good for you. You must be a real movie aficionado.
Well, I looked it up on IMDb, and I said, by golly, that's a film. So I watched it this weekend.
Oh, you did?
Yeah, 1962 film. It's basically about global warming.
It's really a wonderful movie. And the reason I used it was that for whatever reason, I did all my research by reading the LA Times for each day of the 10 days that the book takes place. That was their only source of news. And on one of those days, I can't remember exactly which one, the LA Times put out the list of 10 recommended disaster movies. I mean, here we are in a war, and they're encouraging their readers to watch disaster movies. This was one I hadn't heard of, so I rented it from Netflix It's a very low-budget movie made by an English director.
Mm-hmm.
And such a good movie. And so interesting. It's like a combination of a newspaper room movie with a disaster movie, and I really enjoyed it. So that's the main movie that they watch. They watch some others like Casablanca, but we don't have to watch them with them.
And a long discourse on the on Ingmar Bergman films.
Oh yes, well because I took my novel from Boccaccio, I had to get back to the plague somehow, and The Seventh Seal was one of my favorite movies. One of the first movies I ever saw in college that wasn't like a Hollywood movie. And I threaded that one in too.
You'd used Lear as a narrative structure for 1,000 Acres. Were you just sitting on your porch or at the beach reading 900 pages of Boccaccio and said, you know, the Cameron would make a perfect structure for this novel?
Well, actually not. Those who have read 13 Ways of Looking at the Novel know that after 9-1-1, I decided to escape our era by reading earlier works of fiction. And one of the ones I read, and this would have been in about November of 2001, was the Decameron. And it was fascinating to me that here I was reading about the Black Death, and the main thing in the news was the bubonic, the possibilities of bioterrorism and anthrax and stuff. And but I adored the Decameron. I hadn't read it before. And I had thought, I don't know what I thought about it, but I thought it was, when I read it this time, I thought, gosh, this is such a treasure, because there's 100 stories. Some of them are quite simple and just funny jokes. Others are very complex. And when you're in the middle of it or toward the end, all the themes of all the stories begin sort of coexisting in your mind. And you can't even imagine it existing as a film. And in fact, there are Italian directors who have attempted to do a few of the Decameron stories, but they've only managed to film a half a dozen or a few more than that. It's just an overwhelmingly rich piece of art. And I loved that about it, but I also loved the fact that in the middle of the Black Death, he could make jokes, he could write about sex, he could write about very serious subjects and also very frivolous subjects, and he actually causes the Black Death, even the Black Death, to recede in the face of the lives and the minds of his characters. And I loved that, and I thought it was a great thing. And as people who've read 13 Ways knows, I became quite interested in the way that the novel has wrestled with quite a few horrifying things over the course of the last 600 years. And immediately I began sort of thinking about, well, I won't say immediately, but I had been thinking about a book about Hollywood, a novel set in Hollywood, and it just sort of clicked in with the Boccaccio. Maybe it's the olive trees and the Mediterranean climate. But the other thing is, one of the things I love about the Boccaccio is that in his day, Florence wasn't the great center of culture that it became. In his day, it was Naples. And Boccaccio was actually quite resentful of the fact that his father in 1346 had forced him to come home from Naples back to Florence. And Boccaccio was really upset because Florence was such a crass, money-oriented, horrifyingly unartistic place.
Gee, what does that remind us of?
What does that remind me of, you know? So it seemed to mesh to me.
When John Updike reviewed 10 Days in the Hills for The New Yorker, he drew a parallel, maybe wondering out loud, if you were also inspired by the Trojan War. You have an Elena character, could be Helen of Troy. There's there's a Paul. He might be Paris. There's even a Cassie and a Delphine. Cassandra and the Oracle of Delphi. Did that mesh at all?
No. I wish it had. I wish I'd been that smart. You know, but Cassie got named because the person that she's based on is a friend of mine. Her name was Abby, And also, one of my favorite characters in Uncle Tom's Cabin is a character named Cassie. Delphine started out as Dahlia, and I decided I didn't like that name, but I wanted a D name. I knew one of the things I had to do was to make sure that everybody's name started with a different letter so that they wouldn't get mixed up in people's minds. And so Dahlia was a D name, and I had to come up with another D name, and I couldn't think of any. I didn't want Doris or Dorothy. So Delphine sort of popped into my mind, so she became Delphine. I wish I had that huge frame of reference that Mr. Updike has, but no.
How about A Midsummer Night's Dream? No, not either.
No, but you don't know what in your mind, you don't know what in your mind you're referring to, because all the books that you read are kind of wandering around in there together, the various images from those books. And you could be plucking something from a hidden corner that you're not aware of. For example, when I wrote Moo, I named the villain Lionel Gift. And a reviewer pointed out that Gift was the German word for poison or something like that. And I thought, boy, am I smart. And so I took credit for that, even though it had never occurred to me. But, we all, readers and writers all swim around in the same culture. And the reader brings a great deal to the book. And as the reader reads the book, he or she comes to possess the book. And so the meaning that the book has is entirely belongs to the reader. That's the thing I really love about the novel. The novel as a form. Mm-hmm. And so I never would, I try never to resent people who give bad reviews or something like that, because it's their possession, it's not mine. Mm-hmm. And on the scale of, the concrete to the abstract, the novel's way over here in the abstract area. And that means it's experienced even more subjectively than other artworks. And so that means that you're free. You, the reader, are free to experience that novel any way you want.
I want you to read a section, if you would, please. Starting on page 93, I mentioned in the introduction that there's a film that's semi-based on My Dinner with Andre, the movie, and it's X and or NC-17 rating. Why don't we start with Stoney Gave Max a Moment, and we'll go to Connection That Is a Man That a Man and Woman Have. You know where that is? I think that's. You see?
Well, I'll find it.
Okay. Do you want to set it up that they're,
yes.
Essentially they're talking about the movie that Max, the director, wants to make.
Well, they will be. So they have been talking about the movie that the Russians want to make, the remake of Taras Bulba. Max's career is kind of in abeyance. He made a lot of money a long time ago. He also won an Oscar. But for various reasons, he hasn't done much lately. Stoney is his agent had been an extremely powerful, sort of dominating Hollywood man. Imagine Sid Caesar as an agent. And now he has died. That old agent has died, and his son is trying to step into the father's shoes. And so Stoney's a little bit trying to revive Max's career. Stoney gave Max a moment to recover from his rant, then said, "Will you meet with them?" "Will I meet with whom?" "The guys who have this money and this idea. They're afraid someone is going to steal the idea because the book is in the public domain, so they would like to get a script written. They're afraid that more than one person is going to want to remake Taras Bulba." "Well, look at Dangerous Liaisons. Who ever heard of that? And then there were two movies in production." Max was not laughing, but he was definitely grinning, as if he hadn't heard such a preposterous idea in a long time, and he was really enjoying this one. Stoney had to admit that he was a little disappointed in Max's reaction, surprisingly so, since he had been telling Ben Avram for at least a week now that it was never going to fly. As usual, talking about a project made it live, at least a little. He tried one last thing. "Max, think about being the boss. Think about doing it your way and not having some 25-year-old studio guy on the phone to you every day, second-guessing everything you do and worrying about money. Wouldn't that be fun for a change? You should just read the book anyway. You like to read." Max turned suddenly and leaned toward him. He said, "I'd rather do my movie." "What's that one?" "My Lovemaking with Elena." "Excuse me? Did you ever see My Dinner with Andre? Set in a restaurant in New York or something like that?" "Yeah." "I saw a bit of the beginning. I think I fell asleep after that. This is a joke, right? You're getting back at me for Taras Bulba, but you should read." "No, I think I could do it. It's interesting. A man and a woman are alone in their room for 90 minutes, and they make love and have a conversation." Stoney said, "Max, that's called pornography." "Not if they have a conversation." "What would they talk about?" "Well, that would depend on what day it was. If the movie were made today, they would talk a lot about the Iraq War. Obviously, they would talk about their children. They could talk about anything. That's what conversation is, associating ideas." "Are these two married?" "I don't think so." "How old are they?" "Early to mid-50s. "You want to make a Hollywood movie about an unmarried couple with grown children talking about the Iraq War and making love with graphic sex? You know better, so this must be a joke. It has every single thing that Hollywood producers hate and despise and that American audiences hate and despise. Fornication, old people, current events, and conversation." "You might be able to do it with Clint Eastwood, but unless the girl was 40 years younger than he is." But Stoney couldn't go on with that. Even thinking about Eastwood made him too nervous. He shook his head and said, "How did you get this idea?"
Yeah, that's fine. Yeah. It's approaching, you know, we're getting the satire, we're getting the inside Hollywood jokes. You pulled back, I think, from a full-on, full-blown satire of Hollywood. Mm-hmm. You poke at it, but you don't, you know, punch at it. Was that a conscious choice?
Well, you know, I love movies, and I didn't want to satirize Hollywood. Everybody I've ever met who was involved in the movies, well, let me start that a different way. Once I did a book about the craftspeople in the Catskills, and one of the guys that I interviewed was a ceramicist. And he had two lines. One was expensive and one was cheap. They were both good, though. And he said to me, "It's not money that contaminates art. It's art that contaminates money." And I remember thinking, that is so true. And that's really true of Hollywood. When I was listening or watching the DVDs of all these movies that I watched, and there were a lot of them, quite often they would have the director on to talk about his vision. And it didn't matter what piece of crap he had done or why, he still had a vision. It was still art was contaminating commerce in the DVD. And that's the part that I think is that often goes untalked about in Hollywood novels. Yes, they have weird lives. Yes, they make a lot of money. Yes, they're shallow in some ways. But they also have an artistic vision. If they didn't, they wouldn't be doing this. And so I wanted to come at it through that way rather than through the other way. Always remembering, of course, that when Boccaccio lived in Florence, he said that the artists and other people, craftspeople he knew, were crass and money mad. And yet, when we look back to the Renaissance, we see only beauty. We see only art. Well, those art studios where they were turning out, you know, one beautiful angel after another, that was a business. And that's true of Hollywood, too. And so I didn't want to do a full-on Hollywood satire. I also liked my characters. It's funny to me, to see, or not funny, but amusing to me to see who various people think I'm satirizing. Almost everybody thinks I'm satirizing Paul, the guru. I love Paul. You know, almost nobody thinks I'm satirizing Elena, the one who's so against the Iraq war, but I am satirizing Elena. She too has her foibles. And so I wanted not so much to satirize my characters as to empathize with them from a distance. And to be able to see things both through their point of view and see them a little bit from the outside.
Yeah, the people in the novel, and maybe a few people reading the novel, might roll their eyes at Elena's, you know, persistent need to talk about the war. She can't go through a day, really, without getting a
right.
look at the headlines that are only going to depress her and make her more
right.
anxious. Whereas Paul, as you say, you give him some elegiac words and some big ideas. He's not the not the goofball that he could be.
My favorite moment is when Paul says something out by the swimming pool, and Stoney and Cassie, who's been in Hollywood since God was young and knows everything about Hollywood, they give each other a little glance, and Stoney knows that what they're both thinking is, if he's so smart, why isn't he famous? Which is a Hollywood thought, you know. But I really like Paul, and I like his ideas. And even though he's a fool, he's always right.
I guess I'm perplexed by what we were talking about earlier about the idea of commerce and art corrupting
mm-hmm.
money, because it seemed to me.
No, it's well.
Did I get it backwards?
No, you got it right. But I didn't use the word corruption. That you can't have pure commerce, because as soon as people begin to create, they begin to have choices, they begin to make choices, they begin to want to do something that makes the piece of art that they're doing their own. I always, when I was a kid, read the Bobbsey Twins, which were written by Laura Lee Hope. Who knows who Laura Lee Hope was? And I used to really ponder why in the Bobbsey Twins at school, Freddie and Flossie were 6 and Nan and Bert were 12, while in the Bobbsey Twins at home, Freddie and Flossie were 4 and Nan and Bert were 8. I mean, that was truly something that bothered me when I was a child. But even the hack writers who were writing the Bobbsey Twins and holding their noses while they did it, they still had to exert themselves to make those children interesting and to make things happen. To me, that's the wonderful thing about art, that if you're free, and you always are free in a work of art, you'll assert your freedom.
Mm-hmm.
And then that's what makes the piece of art come to life.
Well, it seemed to me from reading it that there were two Gatsbyan green lights, you know, when Gatsby's looking off the distance at Daisy's boat dock, and that green light is the hope that he's going to get with Daisy. There were two.
Uh-oh.
One of them is white, the Getty Art Museum, that
uh-huh.
people kept looking toward as an ideal, I think, and then literally a green painting, the alleged Vermeer, has the woman in a green dress.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was taking away, maybe incorrectly, that art is what we are to achieve. It's our higher ambition than all the muck and violence mm-hmm. of war and all the screw-ups that people have in their daily lives.
Well, I would say that, yes, that's in here, but I didn't intend it to be in here. You know, I intended the book to be about war and sex, and it ended up being about love and art, you know. Now, why is that? Well, that's the Boccaccian influence, because when he starts in with his book about Florence, the introduction is about how horrible life is in Florence these days during the Black Death, and yet you take away from the book not how horrible life is, but how completely resilient and indomitable life is. That even faced with death, we're still going to talk about sex. We're still going to eat a lot of food. We're still going to have sensual enjoyment, which is what they do when they're walking around and swimming and stuff like that in the Boccaccio. So I guess that was the thing I didn't expect, was that my pleasure in making up all those paintings and movies was going to turn out to be life-affirming. The things that you mentioned, the green dress and the Vermeer, and what was the other one? The
Getty Art Museum.
Oh, the Getty. You know, I had a dream. No, this wasn't a dream. I was driving up the 405, and I went into some kind of a fugue state, and I said to myself, "What is that snow-covered mountain peak up there?" And then I sort of woke up, and I said, "Wow, it's the Getty." The other thing was that the very first time that I did go to the house in Pacific Palisades, I was invited to a New Year's Eve party on New Year's Eve 1999 there. It happened to be the house owned by Andre Agassi and Brooke Shields when they just got married. And I was invited because a friend of mine was his sports medicine doctor. So I got to go. And from their back porch or their back deck, you could see the Getty. And it was a beautiful sight at night to look across there. And so when I found the Russian house, I wanted to make them be able to see the Getty too. The Getty symbolizes so many things in our world. For one thing, all the oil millions that were the source of the Iraq War. For one thing, the gathering of art in the place where it wasn't made, Los Angeles. And then for this other thing, this kind of unreal thing in the distance that these people can look at and wonder about and think about.
You, at least twice, you've had direct experience with Hollywood. They took your novella, The Age of Grief, and turned it into The Secret Lives of Dentists.
Yes.
With Campbell Scott and Hope Davis. 1,000 Acres was released. That's Jessica Lange, Jason Robards, Michelle Pfeiffer, and on and on and on. When you have to give up your art, your craft, your words, mm-hmm. and hand it over to Hollywood, what's that experience like?
Well, with 1,000 Acres, it was virtually meaningless because 1,000 Acres, I felt, was my version, my production of King Lear, and then the movie was their production of King Lear, and nobody gets to possess King Lear, so you get to do your production, and then it goes on, and that's how I saw that. The experience with The Age of Grief was, in some ways, stranger. Excuse me. Stranger than that, because they did not acknowledge my existence while they were making the movie. The first part of the advance had been paid long before. They bought it from the people who had bought it from me. They didn't pay me the second part of the advance. They didn't even send me a free ticket, much less much less bring me to Sundance to walk along the carpet. You know.
Yeah.
They acted as if I was already dead. And so I was really upset, and I was determined to hate the movie. So I bought my own stupid ticket, and I went to the movie, and I thought it was great. And then I took my younger daughter, who was now 21, I think, and she had inspired the 2.5-year-old who hates mom in the Age of Grief movie. In the Age of Grief book. And she was, it was so funny to see the movie with her because she said, "Well, don't tell so-and-so, her boyfriend, because then he'll think my imperious nature is a very long standing." But I loved the movie. I said to her, "You know, if Campbell Scott had been your father, we wouldn't be divorced."
Yeah.
I loved what they did with the children. I loved him. I liked the way that they split. They personified his inner life. I just thought it was a wonderful movie and very funny. And I said, "God, this must be a really great book. I'll go back and read it again." And I only got about halfway through it. I said, "I like the movie better."
Where do you feel you're from? I mean, you were born in Los Angeles. You grew up...
I don't feel I'm from anywhere, really. I feel I'm from the world of literature. I grew up in St. Louis. That was fine. My family wasn't from St. Louis. My mother and her sisters and brother had grown up in Illinois, where my grandfather worked for International Shoe Company. I was raised in large part by my grandparents on a little town, on a little street in Webster Groves, Missouri. And we had a few relatives around, but there wasn't the sense of that they had real roots there.
Mm-hmm.
And then I went off to college, and then I ended up in Iowa. And so I think my real roots are in the Bobbsey twins, you know, and David Copperfield. And this year, when I was doing the paperback of this in England, and they stuck us in a hotel in Holborn, and I was walking around looking at the street names, which I really adore, and I was thinking how deeply I had been attached to just English street names from, you know, the first time I read The Hound of the Baskervilles, mm-hmm. you know. And so I guess that my deepest attachments have been individual people and language and books rather than particular places.
So as a writer, it's not important to have a sense of place?
Nothing is essential to any given writer. Whatever, I think I do have a sense of place, but it's a sense of observation rather than a sense of attachment.
Mm-hmm.
But as I say in 13 Ways of Looking at the Novel, the only thing you need to write a novel is the unkillable desire to write a novel. The qualities that belong to William Faulkner aren't going to be the qualities that belong to you. But something will belong to you that doesn't belong to William Faulkner. And so we can't really... We can only say that novels exist and people write them. Some people view the originating of a novel as something that they draw it up from themselves. I don't view it that way. I view it as the river of the novel passing through you and choosing you as a conduit to carry it forward in your way as a trickle or whatever. You know, you're just a vessel for literature to move itself forward another generation.
After you've won a Pulitzer, how do you go back to your desk without thinking, well, what am I going to do for my next Pulitzer?
Well, you have to have already been back to your desk before that. You won that Pulitzer or whatever award. And that's exactly what happened to me. I knew that I was going to write 3 books about agriculture. And that the first one was a tragedy, 1,000 Acres, and the second one was a comedy, Moo. And I wasn't quite sure at that point what the third one was going to be. But I was well into Moo, and I was also 4 months pregnant when I won the Pulitzer. So all the questions were answered. No, I couldn't go anywhere because I was pregnant and throwing up all the time. And... yes, I'd already started on my next novel, which was entirely different from the first one. So there was no existential dread there. I was already going.
You were pretty proud of the Pulitzer, though, right? I mean...
Well, I of course I was. But I thought it was so amusing the way I found out about it. I lived in Ames, Iowa at the time, and Ames was the home of the Ames Tribune, the small local newspaper. And on the morning of April whatever, the phone rang, and it was somebody from the Ames Tribune. And they said, have you heard anything from Columbia University? No. Have you heard anything from New York? No. Have you heard anything about the Pulitzer? No. So finally the guy said, okay, if you had heard that you had won the Pulitzer, what would you say? So I said something. And then I went over. My daughter was home from school that day. She was 14. And I sat down with her and I said, you know, I think I just won the Pulitzer Prize. She said, cool. And I thought, well, there's a deflating remark. And so then the New York Times, I called the New York Times Book Review because I was working on a review for them. And I said, you know, have you heard anything about the Pulitzer? And she said, no, we won't hear anything until this afternoon, about 2 o'clock. And I said, well, somebody just called me, and I think I just won the Pulitzer. And she said, well, here at the New York Times, we say 80% of rumors are true. I thought, wow, I've got a 4 out of 5 chance. So then I went to my office to teach my class, and at 2 o'clock, which was 3 o'clock Eastern time, phone rings in my office. And it's a guy from the Washington Post asking me for a quote, because it's just coming over the wires that I want. And so I started talking and doing all this stuff. And then I heard this scream outside the door of my office. And it was the Des Moines Register. It was a stringer from the Des Moines Register opening the Ames Tribune, which is an afternoon paper, and seeing that she had been scooped. And what happened was that Michael Gartner had run the whole Pulitzer. He owned the Ames Tribune. And he had run the whole Pulitzer thing. And so he had given the Ames Tribune the scoop to it, just specifically to drive the Des Moines Register crazy. And so, yes, there were lots of little things like that that made me think of it as an experience rather than as an achievement in some ways.
Let's have you read again, if you don't mind.
Okay.
From 299, starting with Everyone Else Was Silent.
Ooh, what is wrong with them?
To 301, when Charlie says, geez. Do you want to set it up?
Okay, let's see what we're doing here. This is day 6. Oh, they're talking about horrors. Horrible things.
Politics.
And politics. Okay. Max, I think, has just related a horrible murder story that happened in Washington, D.C., and that's why they've fallen silent. Charlie is Max's old friend. Max is a director. Charlie's about his age. He's from New Jersey, and he's come out probably because his marriage is breaking up and he can't take it anymore. And also because it's winter in New Jersey, and why not? But Charlie has a much different attitude about the Iraq war than the others do. Everyone else was silent for a moment, and Charlie came back in. He said, "What's up?" He seemed to Paul as if he was making an effort to be patient. Paul said, "That's a gruesome story, but maybe it would be comprehensible if we knew more about it. If we knew about the trial of the painter and his assistant, for example. If they said what their motive was. Maybe it's not truly incomprehensible, just that there isn't enough data." "I think the war in Iraq is incomprehensible," said Elena. "Yes, Mom, we know that," said Simon, but not impatiently. Really, Paul thought, there was something intriguing about Simon's temperament. "But I spend a lot of time trying to comprehend it. I feel like the fact that I can't comprehend it and others can means that most of the people in the nation are suddenly incomprehensible to me." "Okay," said Max, putting his arm around her, "but let's not talk about that particular case, at least not yet." "Wasn't the Rwandan massacre incomprehensible?" said Zoe. "A plane was shot down, and that seems to have been the signal for all the Hutus to drop what they were doing and kill their neighbors with machetes. To me, that's way more incomprehensible than Hitler and the Nazis. Hitler spent years cultivating his infrastructure with movies like Triumph of the Will and that sort of thing. And then when he did start massacring the Jews and all the others, he did it secretly behind walls and in ghettos and outside of Germany. But with the Rwandans, it was like a massive infection or a poisoning. They weren't doing it, and then they were." "But how does that make you feel about humans?" said Stoney. Zoe sniffed thoughtfully. Then she said, "It doesn't make me feel one way or another. It's too incomprehensible." "Well," said Delphine, "my guess is that we don't understand Rwanda because we're ignorant about pre-existing conditions there. I heard overpopulation was a problem and tribal enmities left over from the colonial period. And wasn't there a war there before, sometime in the 60s? But I must say that one thing I noticed when I first came to the U.S. was that after the civil rights movement, the whites got more openly fearful, and you could see during those years when there were riots in Watts and all, that they couldn't help feeling that black people were going to switch over just like that, all at once and in the course of a few days, and start killing as many white people as they could. But in fact, black people never thought like that. So it had to be guilt on the part of the whites and a sense of powerlessness on the part of the blacks that prevented it. I still find it incomprehensible, said Zoe. What about Jeffrey Dahmer, said Stoney. Was he comprehensible? If he never said how it felt to be him, if he couldn't explain what was going on inside his head in a way that other people can grasp, then how are we going to be able to comprehend that sort of thing? Why do we want to, said Simon. Because it exists, said Stoney. I think it's a fetish, said Paul. I think there's a brain mechanism, and that it's the mechanism of the fetish. Here's a clue. There are people who go to doctors and have healthy limbs amputated. They're called apotemnophiliacs. Most of them, if not all of them, have a specific memory from early childhood of seeing an amputee and becoming preoccupied with that idea or image, then harboring and developing that image as an image of themselves. Pretty much all of them say that they would just feel more right, more truly themselves, if they had an amputation. Jeez, said Charlie.
Get a real sense of how this and many other conversations that take place in both the great houses are very centered on politics. Elena, as we've already alluded to, kind of annoys people with how much she's pushing the mm-hmm. the loathing of the Bush administration and the war itself. It's hard not to, even though I shouldn't as a reader, it's hard not to see Elena as a personification of Jane Smiley person, especially mm-hmm. when you take into account your blog on Huffington Post mm-hmm. and other things you've written, nonfiction. So,
well, She has my feelings. I did find it difficult to understand the Iraq War and to comprehend why people would do that. But she doesn't have my being or my personality. She's a person who cleans house. I mean, she's writing a book in the novel about how to do everything correctly. And I would never write a book like that. I don't know how to do anything correctly. But you can see how a certain type of person who's a very orderly person and has made her life around being orderly would not only be morally upset by the Iraq War, but would also be kind of viscerally upset by the Iraq War. And so I gave her my thoughts, but not my personality.
There's two ways that time shows up in two novels. Jenny, the eldest daughter in 1,000 Acres, seems to be compelled by a sense of time getting shorter. She says that a lot. And Paul, the guru, the therapist, maybe, he may be a charlatan, we don't know.
He's always right, though.
Paul is compelled by the expansion of time. Mm-hmm. What's going on with you and time with these two
books?
Well,
I don't know, because I wrote 1,000 Acres in 1992, and I wrote this in 2005. So my ideas about time and life and the passage of time have really changed. I mean, I'm 50, almost 59 years old now, and it seems to me the last 30 years have been really quite brief. When I was 40, or however old I was, I can't even remember how old I was when I was writing 1,000 Acres, I had children in the house all the time. Time seemed to expand, I think because there were so many duties to do. And so that's one of the things that happens when you're a novelist. You're always sending out a bulletin about how ignorant you are at any given moment in your life, because you're not finished. You're not finished thinking about things. When I wrote 1,000 Acres, I had objections to King Lear. Subsequently, I went to, for various reasons, I thought it was a patriarchal tract, blah, 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 blah. Subsequently, I went to a conference in L.A., and there was a woman from Cambridge who was sitting at the conference, and she talked about how there was some evidence that Shakespeare's father had Alzheimer's. And I suddenly saw Shakespeare not as a person who identified with the patriarchy or identified with Lear, but I saw him as a person perplexed by what to do about his father, who is split himself into the three daughters, the one who wants to do the right thing, the one who's torn, and the one who's really pissed. And so that gave me a different idea about Shakespeare and King Lear. Then I read A Winter's Tale, and I realized that A Winter's Tale is quite a bit like King Lear, only Shakespeare has come back to that material a few years later, and his ideas about what love is, about what life is, about whether people can be redeemed or not, have changed. And so I think that if Shakespeare can change, I can too. So can everybody else. No, as you write, no book that you write is the definitive statement of what is true. Every book you write is about how you thought about this thing when you thought about it again. And if you're lucky, you get to be inventive enough so that you can think about things over and over again. You can be Charles Dickens and have Mr. Micawber appear, the debtor appear the way he is in David Copperfield, and then you can have Mr. Dorrit appear as the debtor some years later in a much different way. And wow, lucky us that we get to read all these books by these great writers in which they do change their minds and they do rethink things. And that book that was considered valueless in one era becomes to be considered valuable in another era. So I think it's great. Lots of books are in print. Let's read.
Will you tell us what your next novel's about?
Yes, I've already written two drafts of my next novel, and it takes its inspiration from one of my grandfather's older sisters, who was married to truly, truly, truly a world-renowned crackpot. And he was an astronomer, and he made it his life work to refute Einstein. And he was from Missouri. He's about 6'6". And among the astronomy and physics community, his name is a byword for what not to do. But in our family, he was just seen as this kind of strange, eccentric guy who was married to Aunt Frances, who was herself lots of fun. And so so I was interested in them and in their lives and how they got from Missouri to California where they lived and what it was like. And so I wrote about that.
Got a title yet?
Yes, it's called Show Me.
Okay.
But I'll tell you one thing about this book.
Yeah.
For this book and for Good Faith, I allowed the right to be a character in the book to be sold at the Thoroughbred Retirement Foundation auction. And in Good Faith, there's a character named Betty Baldwin. And for $10,000, a woman named Betty Baldwin bought that character. And I said, okay, Betty, what do you want to be like? And she described the kind of person she wanted to be like. And I said, okay, I can fit that in. And that's the mother-in-law. This time, there was a little bit of a vying for this, and they sold it for $25,000. And the person who bought it was a man named Peter Krasenko, who was a Russian banker who worked for an English bank and was based in Moscow, I think. And so I called him up, and I said, look, I have this book. There's a lot of Russians in it. Can I just stick you in this book? He said, no, I want to be in the new book. I thought, oh, how am I going to get a Russian into the new book? I said, okay, well, what do you want to be like? He said, well, I want to be a Ukrainian adventurer who's made and lost many fortunes. I thought, okay. And he said, I want to be named Pete. So I said, okay, I can do that. So So the book, he started out as a minor character, but after I'd written the whole draft of the book, I called the woman at the Thoroughbred Retirement Foundation. I said, you better get more money from this guy, because he's now a major character. And so that was another influence on the book, that that I had to incorporate a character who had been sold at auction.
And you called him Pete. You didn't call him
Pete.
Oh,
he has to be called Pete.
He's got to be called Pete.
Pete Krasenko. So we'll see how it works. I like him. He's nice.
Last chance, people. No one's. I don't see a line at the
here
thing.
Comes
oh, dude,
one.
Come. Please. Tell us your name.
Debbie James.
Great.
Hi, Jane. Could you talk about how you got your first book published?
How I got Barn Blind published. Well, that's kind of a funny story, because I wrote it, I was pregnant with my first child, and I had gone to Breadloaf previously, the previous summer, and I'd had a few stories, and I sent them to some people, and an agent sent them to some people that I met at Breadloaf, and nobody wanted the stories. That was before the era when they were publishing books of stories, really. And so I had a few pages of Barn Blind, or a few chapters of Barn Blind, and I sent them, and this agent sent them to a woman that she knew and at Random House. And the woman made a small offer. And I said, but Elaine, you can't sell it to her, because we promised it to my best friend, who was a beginning editor at Harper & Row. And so she showed it to Barbara, and Barbara made another small offer. So they had a white hot auction that got up to $7,500, and then they took me out to they both took me out, one for a drink and one for dinner, and then I had to choose between them, and of course I chose my best friend, and so we were together. But then she suffered the editor's fate. You know, just before that book was published, she went to another company, and she bought another book there. And then just before that book was published, she went to another company. So, but it didn't. It wasn't bad. I just kept on writing and kept on going, and that's the way it works. I actually think it's better, or at least in those days, it was better to start small. And to publish, to get your novel published, to work with an editor, to get a few pats on the head from the reviewers, and to be back at your desk doing the next one. I'm not sure that the culture of big advances and trumpeting the work of beginning writers has really helped those beginning writers to go on and have productive careers. I always wanted to have an English-style career. I read about Somerset Maugham. Somerset Maugham wrote 1,000 words a day, and on word 1,000, if he hadn't come to the end of the sentence, he'd stop. And yet, you know, he had book after book after book. And I wanted to have my career be on the English model, you know, where you just published a lot of books, and they had more interesting relationships to one another, and you were prolific and productive, and you didn't commit suicide. either intentionally or unintentionally by drink.
So far, so good.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, please.
Hi, my name's Mary. I have two questions. What are you currently reading now? And can art exist as art without commerce?
No and no. I just finished. I'm doing some book reviewing, so I happen to be reading. I just wrote, blah, blah, blah. I just read What Was Lost, the book that won the Costa Prize for the first novel in England, and that's coming out in the States in, I think, the beginning of June. I just read that for the LA Times, and I'm giving it a good review. And then I have another book to review for The Guardian. And other than that, what was I reading before I read those? I did a piece for The Guardian about one of my favorite Anthony Trollope novels, but very obscure, called The Kellys and the O'Kellys, which I highly recommend if you can find it. It was his second novel, and It's a wonderful, wonderful novel. It came out in 1848. He was 30 in his early 30s when he wrote it. And you just cannot believe how mature his insights were. It's a really wonderful novel. And can there be art without commerce? Well, it's difficult. There has to be at least a trickle of commerce. Somebody has to want to experience the piece of art that you have produced. And generally, they prove their desire to experience it by paying for it. Freud said that people wouldn't value psychoanalysis if they didn't have to pay through the nose. And it's not quite like that with novels, but I do think it were in our culture, people show that they value something by paying for it. But that said, you know, the novel was always meant to be commercial. And one of my favorite stories is about Daniel Defoe, who got his start writing fiction by writing pamphlets about allegedly from the point of view of men and women who are being hung at Tyburn in the early 18th century. And these pamphlets would be sold for a penny among the witnesses to the hanging, and it would be like a confession. And it taught Defoe the value of commerce, and it also taught him the value of using the first-person point of view. So then when he was an older man and he wanted to do something fictional, he wrote books like Robinson Crusoe and Moll Flanders from the first-person point of view. It taught him to empathize with lots of people and criminals and also to make money off of it. And so whenever I feel that the novel in any given era has gone too far in the arty direction, I try to remember Defoe and his origins and know that the novel began as absolute crap and owes a lot to that.
Maybe one more. Do we have one more? Yeah, go ahead, please.
Hi. My name is Irma, and I loved The 13 Ways of Looking at a Novel.
Oh, thank you.
It's sort of my reading checklist.
Oh, good.
Did you have fun writing that? And were there any books that you, in retrospect, wish you had added to your list that you didn't?
I had a wonderful time writing it. I would say to the children, oh, don't bother me. I need to read a book. And lock the door, you know. So yes, it was wonderful to read the books. The books really did generate their own ideas in my mind. And instead of writing it continuously the way I write a novel, I did write it in spurts as I read more and more books, and they sort of got me going with on various ideas. The other great thing about it was that it didn't have the kind of integrity that a novel subject has, and so I could do various rewrites of it, and I would come to things that I'd written before, and I'd say, ugh, this makes no sense at all, and I'd madly rewrite it, and I enjoyed that too. It was a purely pleasurable instinct. I mean, experience. There were books that I thought I would like The Grapes of Wrath that I had liked before that I couldn't get through. There were other books that I didn't expect to I can't remember. It's not really in my mind at the moment. But there are other books I didn't expect to like that I really liked. I didn't intend to read the Proust, but then I had 3 months, and why not? And that was an incredibly great pleasure. I didn't expect to like Justine by the Marquis de Sade, but it was riveting in more ways than one. So it was wonderful to write that book. And it did not make me... The reason I have no regrets about books that I missed is that it charged up my reading so that I went on and read a whole lot more books. It energized me. And so I went on and I read more Zola. I went on and I read more Trollope. And I enjoyed all those books. So now I sort of talk my way into writing little essays for places like The Guardian rather than being able to put it all down in 13 ways.
Jane Smalley, thank you so much for joining us today.
Oh, my pleasure.
It's been a real pleasure to talk with you and a privilege. Jane Smalley's latest novel is 10 Days in the Hills. She writes nonfiction and novels, including 13 Ways of Looking at the Novel, Moo and 1,000 Acres, the winner of the Pulitzer Prize. Thanks to the Tatter Cover Bookstore. Martin Skavish is our audio engineer and producer with help from Dave Fender. I'm Dan Dreher, and this is KCFR Presents.
That's all for tonight's Author on Tour. I'm Darren Fote, and we have been podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore in Denver, Colorado. Stay pod-tuned in the coming weeks for Francis Ritchie and many more as we podcast Authors on Tour. This podcast was originally recorded on April 14th, 2008.